Electoral politics in the age of reform. In general, historians have emphasised the unsavoury nature of electoral politics in the decades before 1832. The Whig historians of the 19th century painted a bleak picture of corruption and venality in the unreformed electoral system. Namier and his colleagues tended to view electoral politics as a projection of the economic power of landowners, patrons and proprietors. Even those who argue that in the early 18th century there was a reasonably representative electorate write dismissively of voters in the Hanoverian period. Four charges were levelled at the electoral system by these critics. One, very few voters were free to vote as they wished. Two, the electorate was thoroughly venal and regarded the vote as a piece of personal property upon which they expected to make a profit. Three, elections were an exclusive proceeding concerning only political and social elites. And four, because the great majority of voters were politically unaware, politics and political issues were unimportant in election contests and ideology had little part to play. These assumptions have been challenged, most notably by Franco Gorman and J.A. Phillips. Their ideas can be summarised thus. 1. The electoral system was controlled by local elites, but with difficulty. 2. The electoral system was never closed, despite its antiquated and unrepresentative features. And 3. Electoral politics was local, and this meant that there was a variety of local traditions and cultures involved, so it's very difficult to come up with a definitive version of national electoral politics. Before we look at some of these points in more detail, I just want to focus on the position of Ireland after the Act of Union from 1801. The Irish constituencies consisted of 32 two-member counties, two two-member boroughs, Cork and Dublin, 31 one-member boroughs, and the university seat of Trinity College Dublin, which returned a total of 100 MPs. They were dominated by the Anglo-Irish Protestant aristocracy. Most boroughs were under close control, but there were chances for independent action in the counties, where the franchise was based on the English system of 40 shilling freeholders. To return then to some of the issues raised in the introduction. First of all, patronage. The potential for control by patrons was widespread in boroughs and in Scottish counties. In its purest sense, a constituency under patronage could be defined as one where one man and his heirs had complete control. However, there was always room for manoeuvre where influence over people was concerned. If an opposition candidate managed to rally enough voters for his side or pay them enough, there could be upsets. In 1792, a survey by the Friends of the People, entitled A Report on the State of Representation, attempted to differentiate between good and bad patronage, categorising them as nomination and influence, respectively. Nomination occurred only in Rotten and Pocket boroughs and arose from the unequal distribution of the franchise. But influence was acquired by wealthy candidates or those with wealthy sponsors and was found in all types of constituency. Patronage was thus an intrinsic part of the electoral system. Namier calculated that in 1761, over half the seats in England were under the control of patrons. If the figures for Scotland, Wales and Ireland are added, it's clear that nearly two-thirds of the seats of the Commons were under aristocratic control. Usually patrons possessed an estate in or near a constituency, which gave some degree of interest, as most voters were the tenants of the patrons. Interest acquired in this way was usually described as natural or family interest. However, this was not usually sufficient to sustain influence except in small constituencies, but it could be used as a base to build up an interest in a wider constituency. It was uncommon for a patron to impose his will upon a reluctant electorate. Voters had to be wooed, and the patron had to show the concern for the material welfare of the voters. They had to serve the electorate and become benefactors to the constituency. The goodwill of the electorate was essential, as they could withdraw their support if they were neglected. A lasting electoral interest could not be built on bribery alone, as the more that was paid out, the more that was asked for. Also, if a candidate prepared to spend more money came along, voters could switch sides. Thus, being a patron was not a straightforward business, neither was it profitable. Expense was involved in donating sums to voters at the time of election and annually to keep up the interest. And being a patron rarely led to high office. Peers were politically important because of their rank, not the numbers of boroughs they had influence over. Electoral interest had a local then, not national significance. Who were the MPs? Membership of the unreformed parliaments were drawn from a very narrow pool. The Knights of the Shires were invariably the sons of the great aristocratic political families. Ownership of land was also an important prerequisite for the representation of borough interests, and the so-called independent country gentlemen proved a formidable backbench force throughout the 18th century and in the early years of the 19th century. Land ownership did not only confer status, the landowner was also proprietor, employer, landlord, and client. There were places for others in Parliament, but these professional, business, and military men often also possessed landed estates. Predominant among the professional men were the lawyers. Perhaps the reason for this was because of their abilities as debaters and public speakers, and maybe because of the close connection between the courts of law and of Parliament, or even because of the benefits of membership of the House brought in terms of career advancement. There were very few manufacturers and industrialists in the House. Occasionally, the sons of wealthy manufacturers, if they possessed enough wealth and talent, could attain membership of the House, Sir Robert Peel being a famous example, but the predominant view was that trade and politics did not mix. The first member of the Commons to sit for a county seat, who was a practising industrialist, was John Marshall, a millionaire owner of several Leeds woollen mills, who became MP for Yorkshire in 1826. Voters, how independent were they? The voters should not be seen as giving blind respect to the patron or accepting political, social or economic inequality. Instead, the constituencies must be seen, as D.C. Moore described them, as deference communities. Patronage depended on a number of variables. First of all, exerting electoral influence took a positive rather than negative step by patrons. Coercion was very rarely tried, as it could backfire. Secondly, control over voters was not absolute. It was never a certainty that a patron's candidate would be returned. Thirdly, it's also impossible to measure how far compliance with a patron's wishes was likely to be a consequence of loyalty and shared economic, political and social values. Fourthly, voters had a definite idea of their own importance. Elections were the one occasion where they were equal or even superior to the candidates and patrons. Fifthly, dissidence was common. Contested borough elections occurred quite frequently. The complexity in landlord, tenant, employer, employee and patron voter relationships has led historians to come up with theories to explain these liaisons. For example, O'Gorman, in a 1986 article, puts forward the mutual theory of deference. That is, that the landed establishment preserved their rule and sustained its authority by acknowledging a set of customary social, political and economic values. Deference did not equal dominance by men of unequal power, wealth and status, but was a reciprocal relationship in which all partners had obligations as well as rights. Election campaigns. often the best organised people during election campaigns appeared to be the unenfranchised, those men who did not qualify for the franchise, and women and children who were excluded. Popular candidates would often receive large followings, and large numbers would accompany them to the hustings. In addition to this show of muscle, the non-electors undertook their own independent canvasses and engaged in campaigns of exclusive dealing. Contests. Only a minority of constituencies went to the polls at successive elections. Indeed, the percentage of seats contested rarely rose above a third between 1760 and 1832. Elections also had little impact on the balance of power between the government and opposition at Westminster. Elections did not create governments, although a ministry always won elections, and usually by a considerable majority. Ritual. The election days themselves were full of ritual and ceremony, described by O'Gorman in his article in 1992. The crowds at many contests could be numbered in thousands rather than hundreds, and it was the custom for electors to tour the neighbourhood, participate in the contests of nearby boroughs. The candidates processed to the hustings in a great parade led by flag bearers and bands playing the raucous election songs of the time. These public displays of support were accompanied by much symbolism and imagery. A final ritual of the election campaigns before the victory dinners and balls took place was the chairing of successful candidates through the streets and alleyways of the town. The chairs were vividly decorated with the colours and symbols of the new members of Parliament. The losing candidates could also be chaired, and if the successful MPs were particularly unpopular, effigies were carried round the town before being ceremoniously and publicly burnt. Alcohol was a crucial component of election campaigns and was liberally distributed to all participants in contests. Popular political interest was also raised by the vast amounts of propaganda spilling onto the streets during election campaigns. Election squibs, handbills, pamphlets and placards all helped to spread the party message. The production of election literature, the provision of colours, bands and flags, the canvassing of electors and the nurturing of the constituencies were all part of the costs of elections borne by the candidates. Figures could reach legendary levels, as in the Yorkshire election of 1807, where costs totaled £250,000. In conclusion then, in the long run, the landed classes maintained their influence over the voting system and were able to influence the majority of voters. But the price patrons and candidates had to pay increased as the 19th century entered its third decade, and the economic and social changes of the period began to take effect. It's possible to see patrons resorting to more and more explicit means of control in a desperate effort to overcome the forces of change. These were both physical, for example, the deployment of the militia and police force, and intellectual. In these circumstances, parliamentary reform was perfectly consistent for the Whigs with maintaining control of constituencies. They argued that aristocratic influence would be continued, but in a purified form. Russell, for example, insisted that aristocratic dominance depended on respect, residence, wealth, munificence, and virtue, and maintained that these qualities would long to be of importance after 1832.